From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama may have gotten millions more votes and raised millions more dollars than any other African-American candidate for president, but he's not the first to throw his hat into the ring. In 1972, former U.S. Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm became the first African-American to seek the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. And whether we're talking Republicans, Democrats, or independents, there are plenty of black folks who've tried to reach the highest rung of elective office. We're going to dig into the ways these candidates shaped history with Ron Walters and Clarence Page. Ron is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. He's also the author of Black Presidential Politics in America, A Strategic Approach. And Clarence Page is a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Hi, Frey.
Good to be with you, Frey.
So let's start with Shirley Chisholm's campaign. Ron, why did she say she was running for president, and what was her approach?
Well, she said she was running for president at that time because Richard Nixon, of course, was president. And many of these presidencies have been arrayed against sort of the conservatism of that particular age. But she wanted to make a mark for African Americans. But she ran a campaign addressed actually to women's issues. And she was a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. And a number of her colleagues had said that they were going to run, but they didn't. But this was a very important year because this was the year of the National Black Political Convention. 10,000 blacks converging on Gary, Indiana.
And that helped shape the whole future of people, not just at, you know, the executive level, but all these different levels of government, correct?
Yes, it announced the coming of a new electoral age. And so Shirley Chisholm's campaign was sort of pegged to that.
So when you say that she focused on women's issues, what kind of platforms was she promoting?
Well, you had some of the same issues that you have today about equal pay for equal work. Certainly, you had the women's right to choose. And those were very important issues at the time because they were part of the women's movement that had come off of the back of the civil rights movement. And so Gloria Steinem and many of the people who were involved in that movement were actually behind the Shirley Chisholm candidacy.
Now, Ron, I'm going to stay with you a second before we go to Clarence. You also worked on Reverend Jackson's campaigns in 84 and 88. So how would you describe what the Reverend and staffers like you were trying to do with that campaign?
Well, this is also interesting because the Jackson campaign in 84 was arrayed against Reaganism. Ronald Reagan had come into office in 1980 and had shown by 1983 that what he was going to do, and he had done a number of things, of course, to devalue civil rights, to put people in office who didn't believe in civil rights, to take money out of the urban areas, to actually be someone that we thought was really against sort of the enlightened age of the 1960s. And so that campaign started in Chicago really as something against Jane Byrne and attracted a number of black ministers. And before you knew it, they were asking Reverend to run for president. And so we lifted that up on the national stage as a vehicle to counter Reaganism. Same thing in 1988. Of course, Ronald Reagan was just leaving office, but his policies were still there. But by 1988, the Jackson campaign had really reached a new level. 3.5 million votes in 84, 7 million in 88. And by the time we got to the convention, Jackson had over 1,200 delegates. So it was really, as people talk today about the first serious campaign. Actually, it was the Jackson campaign in 88 that was the first serious presidential black presidential campaign.
Okay, Clarence, this is going to be the omnibus of questions. Compare for me Reverend Jackson's campaign in 88, Al Sharpton's campaign in 2004, and Barack Obama's campaign today.
Well, I guess the best way to compare them would be evolutionary. Ron certainly touched on how significant the moves were from Shirley Chisholm's campaign to Jesse Jackson's campaigns via Harold Washington's campaign, which, if you look at Eyes on the Prize 2, the last episode is the Harold Washington campaign in Chicago. Many people see that as really being the epitome in many ways, or a completion, if you will, of the legacy of the civil rights movement. And, of course, it won't really be complete until we have total equal rights, and you can put Barack Obama at the end of that. But could Barack Obama be where he is now were it not only for Jackson and Sharpton's political advances, but also for Colin Powell, for that matter, being thought of and being urged to run, even though he didn't, in the mid-90s? It at least got America past the mindset of not being able to imagine a black man or woman in that job. So I would say, in a nutshell, you could say that they're all part of a continuum.
Now, Ron, when you think about how the media has approached the idea of a viable black candidate, it's a phrase that gets tossed around a lot. You argue that Reverend Jackson's 88 campaign was a viable candidacy, and certainly he had a lot of non-black voters who did vote for him. But what does that phrase even mean?
Well, in my book, I argue this, that it really came to mean something a little different. Because if you look at 2004 and the fact that Reverend Sharpton ran, but he didn't really do very well. The same thing with Carol Moseley Braun. It came to mean that black people were interested in finding somebody who was electable. And that's one of the reasons why they didn't vote for them, because John Kerry eventually got their votes. They wanted somebody beyond race who they could actually see in the White House. That also was a sentiment that's carried over to the 2008 electoral cycle, because when Barack Obama won Iowa, that really was the signal. So for blacks in South Carolina to come aboard. And so electability and race really have been the key determinants of what we mean by somebody who's going to run a credible black presidential candidacy.
Clarence, we've also had some interesting contenders. You have Alan Keyes, who has been the only black Republican to run for the White House. He campaigned two times as a Republican. He's running this time around with something called the Constitution Party. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how he approaches race, if at all, in his
runs. I have to also inject Dick Gregory. I don't want to bypass him.
Uh-huh.
Back in the 1960s, there in the late 60s. Thank you, 68, with his protest campaign at that time. I mean, that was a very big deal at the time, just as Julian Bond's nomination from the floor of the Democratic Convention, even though he wasn't old enough to be able to accept. This is all a time of great change that we've been seeing. Alan Keyes, in many ways, is in a political world of his own, a lot of folks would say, because he alienated a number of fellow Republicans when he ran against Barack Obama in Illinois because he was so far right. But he is the darling, I can assure you, of many in the Christian right who I've talked to. I've been to the Christian Coalition rallies in Virginia where Alan Keyes spoke, and predominantly white conservatives jumping up on their feet in tears. They love the man. And he's certainly dedicated to his agenda, which is a very conservative, very socially conservative agenda. And he wants to go back to the Declaration of Independence. They've used the Constitution as rather a radical new document by comparison. But he's always there. And again, I think he did a lot to help folks, say, on the conservative right, to at least get past the idea of not being able to imagine a black president. So I think, in many ways, he's very much a part of this same history.
Now, Ron, what about independent candidates? You mentioned, some of the different people who've run essentially as protest candidates. But, we have had a bunch of different people in different independent parties. And this time around, you have former Democratic Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. She lost a reelection bid for her seat. She's now in the lead for delegates for the Green Party's presidential ticket. What do you think is her reason for running on the Green Party, and what do you think she will accomplish?
Well, we haven't tended to pay much attention to blacks running in independent parties. Clarence is right. You go all the way back to the civil rights period, and you had Dick Gregory. You had, people running on the peace, what was called then the Peace and Freedom Party and the Freedom and Peace Party in the 1960s. The Green Party has evolved as a mechanism for black candidacies. But as I said, no one pays very much attention to them. They get less than 2% of the vote. And so that I think they're really parties that are around to make a statement, and a progressive statement at that. One of the antipathies here is that progressive politics simply doesn't have a voice in the American political culture. And so this is the one place where progressive black politicians have been able to run with some slight visibility to project a progressive voice. But they don't have much political significance, i.e. voter significance for that.
Clarence, when you think about Barack Obama's campaign, which we have covered extensively and pretty much everyone who covers news has covered extensively, what do you think he might have learned from the various candidacies of both major party African-American candidates and some of the independents?
I think he picked up, certainly the kind of lessons we've talked about, the evolution of politics and black politics from civil rights movement on. But I think Barack Obama owes just as much to what he learned as a community organizer in Chicago and a teacher at Saul Alinsky's School for Community Organizers and a man who understood that the civil rights movement was one of many movements in American history that was able to generate progress by pulling people together at the grassroots around common cause. Dr. King's coalition was not just black folks. It was multiracial, multi-regional, multi-religious, and it really got things done. We could certainly see Barack Obama in Iowa, beginning with Iowa. He had more organization than anybody else. Hillary Clinton's campaign took the caucus states for granted. They regret that now. We could see right up to the present, when they go into a new state, they have more people on the ground. They rally the independents out there very effectively. And this is why Hillary Clinton's done so well in the big states, because insurgent campaigns always have a tougher time in the big states because that's where more of the establishment party people are. Hillary Clinton has many more contacts with those party chairmen and that infrastructure. So Obama has learned from history in many ways, I would say.
Ron, just quickly, give me one quick lesson that you think the Obama campaign learned from previous African-American candidates.
Well, I think prescience. That is to say, a sense of timing, knowing where you are in history. Certainly Reverend Jackson, nobody better than him in knowing something about political timing. I think that this campaign is not so much about Barack Obama as it is about the fact that American people really want to change course. They said that in the 2006 election cycle when they changed the Congress from Republican to Democratic control. He was prescient enough to pick up on that, build a campaign around it, and to be able to articulate it with his intelligence.
All right, Ron, thanks so much. We were talking to Ron Walters, professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, author of Freedom is Not Enough, Black Candidates and American Presidential Politics. Also Clarence Page, a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Immigrants flee violence in South Africa. Gay men and women in Gambia face death threats. And against conventional wisdom, does Africa have an obesity problem? That's all in our Africa update. And for more, we've got Nicole Lee. She's the executive director of Trans Africa Forum. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Farai. Nice to be with you.
So let's begin in South Africa. It's been nearly 2 weeks since it was reported that some native-born South Africans started attacking immigrants from other African nations. More than 50 people have been killed and upwards of 25,000 have been displaced. Attackers are accusing the immigrants of taking jobs and increasing South Africa's already high crime rate. President Thabo Mbeki recently condemned the attacks.
We must acknowledge the events of the past 2 weeks as an absolute disgrace. The violence and criminality we have seen perpetrated by a few South Africans is opposed to everything that our freedom from apartheid represents.
So, Nicole, how serious is the situation right now?
Well, Farai, it's pretty serious and a bit unprecedented, although the situation, if you will, it's like a pot that's about to boil over. Now we're seeing that it's actually boiling over. I mean, there are a lot of issues that are facing both the poor in South Africa and those that are fleeing to South Africa. Certainly the situation in Zimbabwe, the economic and political crisis there, has certainly resulted in millions fleeing to South Africa. There are at least 4 million Zimbabweans that are in South Africa right now, not to mention, of course, Mozambicans and Nigerians and Somalians. And I think the second and what's most disturbing is what this is showing us is despite the promises of the end of apartheid, the government has just simply been unable, due to the lack of resources, resolve the economic legacy that we see of apartheid. People are still in South Africa living without clean water. They are still living in substandard housing, no electricity. They don't have access to health care. And so all of these things have unfortunately created a situation where those in South Africa have turned on those who are also the most marginalized in their country, which are people that are fleeing persecution or violence in their own countries or just looking for a better way of life. And those are the immigrants that have been attacked.
There are several studies that have looked at what's sometimes called economic apartheid, where although Africans who are black Africans native to the region in South Africa, as well as people who were called coloreds and people who were Asian, now have full political rights, they have not always been able to make gains economically. So is the country going to do anything, or what is it doing around these economic issues?
I think that these are the sorts of issues that the trade unions, COSATU, the Congress on South African Trade Unions, that the churches have been bringing up ever since democratic elections in 94. What they've talked about is certainly we have now political rights, and these are terribly important, and we fought for these. But we also fought for economic rights. And one of the things that people forget, especially in this country, is that apartheid was not just about political rights. It was about economic rights and economic prosperity and the ability to gain wealth. And unfortunately, due to a lot of factors, we are still seeing those in South Africa, both what would be considered coloreds and blacks, still living in very substandard conditions. And until the country is really able to address those, we are going to see this sort of violence in South Africa. But it's something that certainly advocates on the ground have been pointing to quite some time. And so hopefully the government will be able to move more quickly. The government has certainly done a lot. Built housing. They've certainly done a lot in terms of health care, or have attempted to do something in terms of health care. But more must be done. The need is just far greater than the capacity.
South Africa is a nation that is known on the continent for having some pretty liberal laws around gay rights and human rights. And, for example, marriage is legal for South African gays and lesbians. But that's not necessarily the case in every African nation. And so the president of Gambia threatened to cut off the head of any gay person in the country. Last week at a political rally, the president said gay people had 24 hours to leave the country and promised, quote, stricter laws than Iran on homosexuality. So this country is also the host country for the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Nicole, what's been the reaction both inside the country and from other African nations?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the reaction has not been as boisterous as you would have expected. Certainly, there are many countries on the continent of Africa that do have laws on the books that make it very difficult for gay and lesbian people to be open, to rally around each other for better rights, and even economically to benefit on the continent of Africa. And so, although certainly the international treaties do recognize people have the right not to be discriminated against based upon sex, and some have looked at that and said, well, that means sexual orientation as well. That has not necessarily trickled down into the laws that we see on the books in countries in Africa. So it's been unfortunate, because this would be a real opportunity for countries like South Africa and other countries that do not have repressive policies against gays and lesbians to talk about the invisibility of gays and lesbians, to talk about the stigma, in the hopes that community groups, churches, etc., would feel more free to have these conversations in countries like Gambia.
Now, this is something that some people may not really know or even believe, but there is an issue of obesity on the continent of Africa. Now, in some countries, you are considered prosperous if you are heavier. And Mozambique has had to introduce a new fitness regimen for police officers to try to tackle a growing obesity problem. In Namibia, obesity is causing people to get more type 2 diabetes, just like there is in the U.S. And the World Health Organization estimates a third of African women and a quarter of African men are overweight. And it's going to get higher in the coming years. Now, there is an assumption when you see some of the pictures of people, for example, who are refugees, that this is not something that would happen on the continent. What do you think we're really seeing here? Maybe differences in cultures?
Well, it's interesting, because when we think about the food shortage, you know, in many ways, there really isn't a shortage of food, even internationally. It's just who has access to food and what types of food they have access to. We see this in our own country, where we have food, yet there is much of the food that we eat undernourishes us. And we see this on the continent of Africa as well. You certainly do have a situation where culturally in many countries, the heavier you are, the more that you weigh, it's a sign of wealth and prosperity. prosperity. So if you have a wife that is more has more weight on her, you are seen to be a prosperous man. What we're seeing now is a few things. Certainly, as I stated before, wealth is in the hands of some on the continent, and because weight is seen as a sign of wealth, people do tend to weigh more if they can. But the other thing that we're seeing is how Western diets are influencing the way that people eat on the continent. So just like you can have food but be undernourished, there are so many non-foods that we find in our fast food, like high fructose corn syrup, that we're seeing now on the continent of Africa in ways never before seen. We now see that this is in the diets of African people. And so because there is a food shortage, a food crisis that we're seeing, does not necessarily mean that there would not be an obesity problem among those that can afford that type of food.
Well, Nicole, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nicole Lee is the executive director of Trans Africa Forum. She was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. 2/3 of the HIV infections around the world occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Some experts say now is the time to change prevention priorities on the continent. The most common ways of trying to prevent the disease these days are condoms, HIV testing, STD awareness, and abstinence. But a new Harvard study says they're not working. The paper's authors advocate male circumcision and reducing multiple sex partners. Daniel Halperin is one of the paper's lead authors. He's also a senior research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, glad to be on the show.
So, generally, how is HIV most commonly transmitted in Africa?
Well, unlike most of the world, where HIV is mainly transmitted in what we call high-risk populations, which are sex workers and their clients, injection drug users, and men who have sex with men, in many parts of Africa, HIV is mainly spread in the general population. It's spread mainly heterosexually, and a lot of the HIV transmission appears to be happening in regular, more regular partnerships, not so much casual sex or commercial sex, but often you have a scenario where somebody might be married but also has a boyfriend or a girlfriend on the side. So they don't necessarily perceive themselves as being at high risk of HIV infection, but actually they are at high risk because if their partners have other partners who have other partners who have other partners and so on, then what you have is basically a large sexual network where HIV can enter this network and spread around pretty quickly through the network.
I'm going to talk a little bit later about something that you've identified in Uganda that seems to work on that score. But first of all, why don't you tell us a little bit more about how you did the research, what you were looking for, and what you found?
We believe that all these approaches are important. We're not in any way advocating for the termination of programs to promote condoms or for HIV testing or for treating of other sexually transmitted infections or for abstinence. We feel all those approaches have some value. But in terms of really trying to reduce the epidemic, in terms of really trying to bring down the rate of new infections, these approaches appear to have had relatively little impact versus we've seen now several examples of countries where there's been a focus on reducing the number of sexual partners that one has. This was called zero grazing in Uganda. And we see now, not only in Uganda, but in several countries in Africa where HIV has gone down, the main behavioral change that's occurred has been a reduction in the numbers of partners. So we feel that this is an approach that hasn't been employed very much, but could be much more focused on than it has been.
In addition to the issue of sexual partners, you also talk about male circumcision. And before we get into that, there was a reporter in South Africa who actually had himself circumcised as an adult and explained the procedure. He felt clearly very strongly that this was something that would help. You seem to feel that way as well. Why?
Well, there have been dozens, many dozens of studies now over the last 20 years or more that strongly suggest that men who are not circumcised are at higher risk of HIV infection from heterosexual intercourse. Consistently, we see at least a 60% reduction in risk for men who are circumcised. And it's a relatively simple surgical procedure. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes normally for adults. It's done under local anesthesia. There's a lot of demand for it. In many African countries now, there are long wait lists at the public hospitals of men wanting to get circumcised, and there just are not the resources there for them to do it.
Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, was reviled by some people when he said poverty was the cause of AIDS. Regardless of whether or not you think his statement is literally true, is there a grain of truth to it?
Well, we actually tend not to agree. We think issues like poverty, and as well as rape and war and gender inequality, these kinds of issues, which are often associated with AIDS in Africa, we believe there are probably some associations. We certainly are not in any way saying that poverty has no relationship with AIDS or that gender inequality has no relationship. But when we looked, again, very carefully at the evidence, if anything, the evidence seems to go in the other direction. In other words, in almost all African countries, HIV prevalence is higher, and in most cases much higher, in wealthier men and in wealthier women than it is in the poorest people. In fact, 20 years ago, in the then hard hit part of Africa, which is the Great Lakes region around Uganda and Tanzania, the local people referred to AIDS as the fat man's disease or the rich man's disease. They certainly saw it as something that wealthy people were suffering from. And that's simply because wealthier men in particular can have more sexual partners than the poor man can. For the most part, not completely, but for the most part, the hardest hit countries in Africa are the relatively wealthiest countries. I mean, Thabo Mbeki is the president of South Africa, and there's certainly poverty in South Africa. But anyone who's been to South Africa knows that, relatively speaking, it's the richest or one of the richest, most developed countries in Africa. And the parts of Africa that are really dirt poor, that are just, when we conjure up images of people just starving and facing tremendous poverty, that's really, for the most part, in West and Central Africa and some other areas that tend to have actually relatively very low HIV levels. So while it's true that Africa is economically the poorest continent, and it's also the continent that has the most AIDS, within Africa the pattern actually goes in the opposite direction of what Mbeki was talking about.
You've been getting a lot of attention from the popular media, not just the science media, for this study. Where do you think this is going to take the conversation over AIDS in Africa?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, in a sense, one of our objections was to start a debate and start a discussion. We're not saying we have all the answers, but we do feel that we need to reassess HIV prevention, which was the title of the article. And so I'm glad that there has been apparently a fair amount of discussion about this. I think one thing that's interesting to point out is that the approaches which we feel the evidence suggests could have the strongest impact in Africa, like promoting reduction in the number of partners and male circumcision, are actually, in a sense, very much indigenous African approaches. So, for example, the zero grazing campaign that was started in Uganda over 20 years ago was not developed by any foreigner or, you know, international expert like myself. It was totally developed by the Ugandans themselves. So I think we really need to build more on the local culture, the local traditional leaders and traditional healers and religious people and so on. And I think, in my experience working for a long time in Africa now, these kinds of approaches will tend to resonate. I think people in Africa and perhaps worldwide tend to be somewhat suspicious of approaches that feel like they're being imposed on them from the outside. And I think, unfortunately, that's been part of the problem with condom programs. But I think the idea that this is a sexually transmitted disease, that you're at more risk if you have more partners, it seems logical to most Africans, and they can certainly grapple with that and understand that very clearly. And I think circumcision also is not something that's coming from the West. So perhaps Westerners need to have a little more humility about imposing what we think will work on Africa, but letting the Africans themselves develop effective approaches.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Daniel Halperin is a senior research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health's Department of Population and International Health. He's one of the lead authors of a paper which advocates new HIV prevention priorities in Africa. It appears in this month's issue of the journal Science. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. In Somalia and Haiti, residents have taken to the streets in protest of food prices. It's just part of a global problem. A few have even died for the cause. We see the plight on the news, but what does it feel like when those people are your people? What do Americans of African and Caribbean descent do when they see suffering in the countries that they or their parents hail from? Well, today we're speaking with Marjorie Valbrun. She's a Haitian American living in Washington, D.C., and she's written about the issue for the online magazine, TheRoot.com. Hey, Marjorie.
Hello.
So you're Haitian-born. You've been in America for about 40 years now, and you still have family back in Haiti. So when you talk to family, what do they make of the crisis, and how are they dealing with it?
Well, I think they're dealing as best as they can, but they feel, like us, overwhelmed by it, and they rely on us to help them.
Remittances.
Yeah. You could also send food, not really send food, but order food through these online organizations that deliver the food to them. But mostly remittances, yes.
I have family in Zimbabwe, and I have to say that I'm dealing with some of the same issues on a personal level. But when you send money, mm-hmm. do you think that you are, it's the whole thing of, you know, giving a man a fish, teaching a man to fish. Do you have hope that what you're doing will have a long-term impact?
I don't think it has a long-term impact, but I think it has an immediate impact, and that is to keep my relatives alive and, you know, and safe. And so, you know, the long-term impact would be if I were able to bring them all out of Haiti, or, you know, to help them all find jobs, or to, you know, to pay for every single one of them to have an education that would give them a livelihood. But there's not much jobs in Haiti. You know, the country is in very bad shape. So it's a very kind of a circle that just, you know, keeps going. There's not a lot you can do to change things overnight other than really try to help your family and try to help even those who aren't your family through organizations and nonprofits that are down there.
In your piece, you talk in very concrete visual terms about what it's like to walk the streets.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
It's extremely difficult. I mean, you can not walk down a street like in the capital, which is Port-au-Prince, and not be bombarded by beggars. Everywhere. They're everywhere. From the minute you step off an airplane at the airport outside Haiti, they have now put up barriers up to keep the beggars from, you know, just rushing you. And just the need is just overwhelming and saddening. And you just feel from the moment that you're there that you just can't do enough, that you're just, no matter how much you do, it's never enough.
There's the phrase survivor's guilt, which is when, you know, you have a comfortable life, but people you know don't.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
It's very hard, and I have acute survivor's guilt. But what I really try to help. I mean, my siblings, my parents, my cousins, we all, like, make ourselves responsible for a certain portion of families. Like, I'll take care of this family, you take care of that one. And, you know, we send money consistently. We know that they cannot survive without what we send. And, you know, okay, I'm going to pay for this one to go to Catholic school because, you know, there's no free public education in Haiti. And if this one is sick, I'm going to pay the doctor's bill. And a lot of my relatives, you know, they've brought, you know, cousins here and siblings, or they just adopt some of their cousins' children to bring them here because, you know, that's the only way to really save them.
When you think about the history of Haiti, where Haiti actually, after it got its freedom, paid
dearly
millions mm-hmm. of dollars to the French, basically mm-hmm. In this weird move to buy their freedom because they were forced to.
Yeah.
What do you think the international community owes Haiti?
I don't know. I mean, what they owe Haiti, I think that, you know, there's a saying amongst Haitian Americans that Haiti has never been forgiven for having the audacity to, you know, to get their freedom in 1804 because, you know, it kind of gave rise to other revolutionary freedom movements in the Caribbean. And, you know, it was a model for American slaves. I think the international community, the policies are not consistent in Haiti. You know, U.S. policy especially, which is, you know, the leader in terms of the foreign governments that are involved in Haiti, the U.S., the French, the Canadians, is not consistent. You know, there have been times where we have supported dictatorships and other times where we've helped get rid of dictators. U.S. policies in terms of farm policy is not beneficial to Haiti. It's beneficial to, you know, American farming. So it depends on, you know, which administration is in power. I think that, you know, Haiti is important because it's close to the U.S., you know, and this, because it's in the U.S.'s backyard, I think it's, you know, would be important for the U.S. to make sure that things don't continue to become so unstable, because every time that happens, you have refugee flows to Florida, which is what the U.S. doesn't want. I just think that a more consistent foreign policy, a more fair policy would help. But I do think that Haiti, because it's so poor, does get a lot of international aid, a lot, and it's not always used wisely once it's there. There's just so many, you know, outside forces playing into this, and also internal forces. You have a lot of corruption, and, you know, that's something that, you know, I have to be honest about. There's a lot of corruption, so sometimes the money doesn't get to the people who need it. And then we have unstable governments. We have lots of coups. We have, you know, just a revolving door of leaders. And so that's not good for the country. And at the bottom is the people. You know, you have 10 million people. You know, most of them are, you know, poor, dirt poor, live on less than $2 a day. They are illiterate. We don't have an education system. We don't have a civic education campaign. And so there's just like a perfect storm of just so many things that makes Haiti so hard to govern. And I think for outsiders, it's very hard for people to understand why it seems to be in a perpetual state of chaos and crisis. But,
so,
you know,
so
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Where's the hope? I mean, you know, you must have hope, some flicker of it.
I do have hope. The hope, I think, is that, you know, the hope comes from people like myself. We have 1.5 million Haitians living outside of Haiti, and a million of them are in the U.S. The rest are in Canada and France. And, you know, we love the country. We care about what happens there. We are pushing for better policy. We, you know, there's a couple of people in Congress who are very good friends of Haiti. Kendrick Meek, for instance, in the U.S. House. He's from Florida. And before that, his mother was also a congresswoman. So, you know, the Black Caucus is involved. I think that we have to be more engaged in U.S. policy, Haitian Americans who are here, you know, in terms of U.S. policy in Haiti. And for a long time, a lot of Haitian Americans always dreamed about going back to Haiti. But as, you know, the country continued to be so unstable, a lot of them will not go back. They have their lives here. And so they're trying to have some influence there. And there's a lot of Haitian American organizations that are doing that. And the hope also comes from the Haitian people themselves. You know, they're very sturdy group. I mean, if it wasn't for the kind of Haitian mentality of just survival, you know, the island would have just, you know, sunk into the ocean. But they're very industrious people. They're very hardworking people. And, you know, they are starting to push their government as well. And we have now a democratic government. And it's still young. It's still fledgling. It still has a lot of challenges. But it was the Haitian food riots that really made the government take notice, like, oh, my goodness, these people are not going to take this anymore. And, you know, I said in the piece that they weren't just hungering for food in these riots, they were hungering for change. And I think the Haitian population is saying we want things to be different and we're going to push for that. And so I'm optimistic about some of that.
Marjorie, thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Marjorie Valbrun is a Washington, D.C.-based journalist, and she joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. CCH Pounder, or Cece to her friends, is one of those actors with a mutable face. She can look friendly or stern, joyful or veiled. Pounder was nominated for an Emmy for the hospital drama ER, took charge as Detective Claudette Wims on The Shield, and played an attorney on Law & Order Special Victims Unit. She's also done quirkier roles, like her turn as manager Brenda in the 80s art film Baghdad Cafe, also known as Out of Rosenheim.
And nothing so tragic.
Pounder has also used her leverage as an artist to fight apartheid and AIDS, and she owns and runs the Pounder Kone Art Space in Los Angeles. I've had a chance to visit the space and see the art she chooses for her shows, and now Cece is here. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, you have this space in Atwater Village, one of the, for me, living in Los Angeles, one of the eastern parts of L.A.,
but everyone. Coast.
Yeah, exactly. But it's this place where you have, you know, I went to one of your openings and saw another show, and you have such an interesting mix of people who come as well as an interesting mix of artists who show. What does it mean to you, and why did you start the gallery?
Well, I've had the gallery in several places prior. Obviously, I started out in my home like most people, come over and see the art in my living room. And then I moved to Pico and Hauser, which was much closer to where I live. And it's on the south side. And I think myself and Terrell Tilford and Addis Art Gallery, we started to create a wonderful sort of section and really watch the neighborhood change. You know, you change from like car repair shops and you get little cafes and so on. And unfortunately, what happens with most artists is that you make a place more beautiful and everybody puts the rent up. So off to the eastern outpost of Atwater Village, which had one gallery when I got there 2 years ago, which now is about to open its seventh gallery. So I think I've got a track record of bringing good stuff with me.
Tell us about the kind of artists you represent.
Well, one of the things, just before I do that, I think it also sort of represents your neighborhood as well, because the clientele that comes in the door is considerably different. And so I have now Armenians and Asians and Africans, and it's exactly how I pictured it in my mind, and it's coming true there. The artists that I show are basically artists of the African diaspora. Number one, the fact that I am an Angeleno and I live in Los Angeles, I show Angeleno artists as well. If you happen to be an immigrant who lives in Los Angeles and you're a fantastic artist, I am very happy to see your work as well. So I've tried to keep a niche, but it is not restricted to what I say it is. It's restricted to the fabulous work that comes through the door.
And the show that you have up right now references Fela Kuti and has this mix of kind of, you know, urban, Western style portraiture. I mean, you know, not direct, but, you know, kind of interpretive portraiture. And then all these images of Fela is like a cameo in one picture. What did that show say to you?
The artist is Jasmine Murrell. She comes from Brooklyn, New York. And she has what I call a rhythmic style in the sense of her patterning in her paintings and collages. And a young emerging artist, and I thought she had an extraordinary sense of color and design, which reminded me when I was a young girl, I came from Guyana originally, had the accent still, and I had my first American boyfriend, and who insulted me in his mind by saying, the problem is with you is that you mix your checks with your florals, and we don't do that here. And I was saying, but my sense of style is absolutely fantastic and unique. And then to see it years later in paintings of people who have a sense of it's the assault of rhythm and color that comes from our culture is a natural extension for it to be in the visual art. So,
and I saw a mixed media piece that you did. It wasn't for sale, but it was a kind of a toy airplane superimposed with the image of the interior of the slave ships that crossed the Atlantic. What does doing art mean to you?
Well, I try not to sell art personally, as I still consider myself, I am still in the old profession of acting. And I always knew that I was going to do a transfer into the visual arts. But what happened in the between time is that I've become an art appreciator and a collector. And what that piece was about, the previous show was about immigration. It was called Immigration Stories. And the idea that we are all exiting our countries now by any means necessary, by boat, by train, by plane. And The Golden Ticket was the name of that piece. And I found an old Mexican airplane in a Mexican flea market and had it redone in gold leaf paint. And it's literally covered in black and brown babies, and in the sense of the, I use babies because of the innocence that we think we're going to this golden place where life will be better. And when it's mounted, they're hanging off, even they're hanging out of the doors. They're it's just littered, and the runway is the old middle passage of all the slaves on the slave ship.
Before we let you go, of course, I have to ask what you're working on now. What are you doing in the world of acting?
Well, I've kind of got two wonderful things going for me at the same time. You know, my husband and I own the first Museum of Contemporary Art in Dakar, and this was the year he was finally recognized by the European Union. So we've actually had an acknowledgement that a private museum exists and lives, and it's the most beautiful place in Dakar. So I'm really proud of that. And The Shield is over, 7 years. The new season you'll see starting in September with an exquisite ending, which I won't talk about, but definitely worth seeing. And now I'm basically an actor for hire. I'm going off to Canada to do Warehouse 13 as a guest in a new pilot. And I completed a pilot before, which I thought was brilliant, by Meredith Steen. And it was called The Tower, which I hope will have a life later on. But right now, it's not a go. So basically, I'm out and about like everybody else. And after 7 years of sort of knowing where you're going, it's kind of exciting all over again that you're out there pounding the pavement in a funny kind of way.
Very quickly, do you see good things for actors like yourself who, you know, may not fit in one niche, but can go from very mainstream to independent?
If you equip yourself with skills, yes. But to stand and complain with no skills, you've got a problem.
Well, CCH Pounder, great to talk to you.
Thank you.
CCH Pounder is an actor and gallery owner. Her space in Los Angeles is called the Pounder Kone Art Space, and she joined me right here in the studios of NPR West in Culver City.